evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Theodore H. Fleming. He's a world authority on the biology of plant-visiting phyllostomid bats. He has conducted research in Panama, Costa Rica, Australia, Mexico, and Arizona. And we're talking about his book, Birds, Bats, and Blooms, the Coevolution of Vertebrate Pollinators and Their Plants. Ted, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
I really did. The first thing I want to clear up for the audience, because I'm sure a lot of people don't know this, is the difference between nectar and pollen. Because a lot of people just use it interchangeably, and it's not true at all.
That's right. Nectar is the liquid, sugar-rich product of particular glands in flowering plants. So that's the energy source for nectar-feeding birds and bats. Pollen is the male sex cell produced in the anthers, and that contains the genetic information that's transferred as pollinators move from one flower to another. For nectar birds, pollen is not a source of food, at least for hummingbirds, it's not a source of food. But for nectar bats, they can digest the goodies in pollen grains in their stomach and hence obtain various nutrients, including amino acids for building proteins and so forth. So pollen for the bats is a food source, but it's not really a food source for at least hummingbirds.
But they do still transfer it because doesn't it stick to them?
Oh, yeah. Hummingbirds certainly do transfer pollen from one flower to another. But if you can picture a hummingbird and a nectar bat, and probably most people can't, nectar bats are furry like most mammals, whereas hummingbirds are just covered with feathers. And it's been shown experimentally that every time a nectar bat visits a flower, it's picking up a lot more pollen than every time, say, a hummingbird visits a flower. And hence, nectar bats tend to be more effective pollen distributors from one flower to another than hummingbirds.
And as you write in the book, especially over long distances, like if there are isolated populations of these plants, bats can actually carry the pollen with them over long distances, unlike insect pollinators.
Well, I'm not really dealing with insect pollinators, and there are some long-distance insect pollinators also. But by and large, if you compare hummingbirds with nectar bats, for example, hummingbirds tend to be highly territorial.
Right.
Which means that the birds don't move very far when they're feeding. But bats are not territorial, and they have large foraging ranges, and they can carry pollen kilometers at a time, whereas hummingbirds really can't do that or don't do that.
I think that there's a term, mobile link.
Correct. Yeah, Larry Gilbert in 1980 was classifying the ecological roles of different organisms in communities, and he came up with the term mobile link that really refers to, it, in the case of vertebrates, it refers to seed fruit eaters, which disperse seeds, and flower visitors, which disperse pollen. And both of those classes, the fruit eaters and pollen feeders, at least among mammals, are quite wide-ranging. And hence, they are links between populations of plants, and they're especially important as links between plants that are in fragmented types of habitat.
Right. Right. Now, the focus of your book is predominantly the New World. There's a New World focus, but you make a point, and you actually address this in the book. There are nectar-feeding vertebrates found around the world.
Absolutely. And as I say in the book, it's the Old World ecological analogs of the New World nectar feeders are really a beautiful example of convergent evolution.
Right.
There are, you know, several families of birds in the Old World that at least occasionally visit flowers and serve as pollinators. There's one family of bats with just a few species that are in the Old World that are also the ecological analogs of our nectar-feeding New World bats.
I've also seen honey eaters in Australia.
Yes, there are lots of honey eaters. It's a major family of songbirds. It's an old family in the order Passeriformes. And they are very good at dispersing seeds as well as pollen in their habitats.
Now, let's talk about here in the New World, the nectar feeding vertebrates that you were writing about. They're basically hummingbirds and bats. Now, most people are familiar with hummingbirds. And unfortunately, here in the Northeast, we only have one that breeds. We have the ruby-throated hummingbird. Although we do get now strays from the West, we do get things like rufous hummingbird and stuff like that that occasionally come and visit feeders here. But bats, where are the nectar-feeding bats found? Are they found in North America?
Well, certainly, but only in a particular corner of North America, at least the U.S., in southwest U.S., and truly in southern Arizona, there are two species of migrant, seasonally present bats in southern Arizona that are nectar feeders. And I've been studying one of those species, the lesser long-nosed bats, for almost 30 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, let's start by talking about hummingbirds. Family Trochilidae, there's 368 species. But what I was amazed about reading in your book, obviously for a bird that's so small and the bones are so fragile, the fossil record is very scant.
That's correct.
But they once occurred in tropical Europe, because there's no hummingbirds in Europe now, or Africa, or Asia, people should know, but they originally occurred in Europe?
Yes, the earliest fossils dating from about 32 to 30 million years ago were first unearthed in shale deposits in Germany, and they were first reported in 1984. So this is a pretty new discovery, and it really shakes everything up because we've always thought of hummingbirds as being New World exclusively, but they really evolved probably in tropical Eurasia and then got into the New World probably via Beringia sometime before 22 million years ago, because the radiation of New World hummingbirds really dates from about 22 million years, 10 million years after the fossils that were found in Europe.
But none remained in Asia or Europe.
Correct. And there, you know, if you look at the flora of Eurasia, Europe, and so forth, there's no real evidence that there were long, tubular corolla types of flowers that are so prevalent in the diets of New World hummingbirds. So it's really hard to unimagine what the Old World hummingbirds were doing for a food source. But the earliest fossil definitely had a long bill. And it could have probably, and shoulder mechanism that was similar to our New World birds, so it could hover and it could visit long corollaed flowers, but we don't know which kinds of flowers or what lineages of flowers were actually the first food source for old world hummingbirds.
Now, a couple of general things about hummingbirds that you write about in the book. They're closely related to swifts. They have an interesting variety of bill types. Now, you don't see that so much here in North America, but if you ever travel to Central and South America, you'll see like the hermits with their curved bills. There's a swordbill hummingbird that's just got this enormous bill.
Exactly.
How do you account for the variety of bill shapes and the diversity of skull shapes?
Well, the short answer is it's just natural selection in its finest form. Within a period of certainly 20 million years, there's been strong selection on hummingbirds for adapting to particular kinds of flowers. And this has resulted in, you know, as you mentioned, a variety of different bill shapes, short-billed, straight-billed hummingbirds, long-billed, straight-billed hummingbirds, curved bills, and so forth. It's just a reflection of the overall effects of natural selection creating efficient flower visitors. And this supports the idea of adaptive radiation of bill types in hummingbirds.
Now, most hummingbirds have a very small size. As a matter of fact, the smallest bird on Earth is the bee hummingbird. There is a giant hummingbird in the Andes, but it's not like wicked huge. Why is such a small size important for a vertebrate pollinator?
Well, that's an interesting question. The closest relatives of hummingbirds, as you've indicated, are swifts.
Yeah.
They tend to be larger on average than hummingbirds. The range of hummingbird sizes is like 2 to 3 grams up to 20 grams in the giant Andean hummingbird. That's a very small range. But, you know, you could think of hummingbirds as vertebrate extensions of insect pollinators. There's a moth here in southern Arizona, a hawk moth, that's called a hummingbird moth because if you're not looking carefully, it's about the size of an average hummingbird.
We have them here. We have them here, too.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. And so, you know, you could think of the hawk moths are mimicking hummingbirds, but hummingbirds are also mimicking the nocturnal sphingid moths, the hawk moths. Although hawk moths feed both during the daytime and at night.
But hawk moths, like hummingbirds, also hover in front of the bloom as they're getting the nectar out of it.
Absolutely. And instead of having a long bill, they have a very long proboscis.
Right.
That they dip into the flower to get nectar. It's just a beautiful parallel evolution of an invertebrate and a vertebrate.
And they also, hummingbirds and nectar-feeding bats have specialized tongues.
That's right.
Can you describe those?
Well, the hummingbird tongue is basically cartilaginous, and it's kind of a rolled tube that is split on the business end, the front end, with some hairs and so forth. When a hummingbird sticks its tongue into a flower, and it does so very quickly, the tongue kind of unrolls, gets a dollop of nectar, and then re-rolls, and the nectar is squeezed out from the tongue in the hummingbird's mouth. It used to be thought that hummingbirds use capillary action to obtain their nectar. But that couldn't happen knowing the mechanics of the tongue. The tongue flattens, the roll tube basically flattens out, gets a load of nectar, and then refolds and retracts back into the mouth where the nectar is dumped.
Now, what about the bats?
Well, bats, of course, are mammals, so their tongue structure is entirely different from that of hummingbirds. Bats have flexible tongues, and in the case of nectar bats, their tongues are extremely long. But when they stick their face and tongue into a flower, they're picking. They have small feather-like structures at the end of their tongue. They get a which serves kind of as a mop. They get a tongue full of nectar. They pull it back in their mouth and then again squeeze it out. But their tongues are much more flexible than the tongues of birds, and including hummingbirds. So their tongues can be, I photographed these hummingbirds and nectar bats a lot, and my pictures of nectar bats sometimes show these long tongues that haven't been fully retracted into their mouth after visiting flower, and it looks like a big sloppy, structure. The tongues are great in nectar bats because they're given their flexibility, they can groom themselves take the pollen grains off.
And eat them.
And then they're basically feeding on pollen grains as well as nectar. Hummingbirds really don't pick up pollen when they're on their tongues when they're visiting flowers. They pick it up on their feathers, of course. But nectar bats can and do, ingest pollen. Hummingbirds, with their inflexible tongues, cannot do that. And even if you feed pollen grains to a hummingbird, it can't digest the goodies within pollen grains in their stomach. So it's not a source of food. And they get their proteins, of course, by eating small insects rather than pollen.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Theodore H. Fleming. He's a world authority on the biology of plant visiting. Is it phyllostomid bats? And has conducted research in Panama, Costa Rica, Australia, Mexico, and Arizona. And we're talking about his new book, Birds, Bats, and Blooms, The Coevolution of Vertebrate Pollinators and Their Plants. One of the things you write about in the book is that unlike insect pollinators, hummingbirds are really good at getting nectar from high elevation plants that are growing up, say, in the Andes, and other things can't do that.
Yeah, well, as you go up the mountain, it gets colder, so that kind of filters out most of the lowland insect pollinators.
Yeah,
but hummingbirds, in contrast, have thrived and have actually radiated extensively at high elevations, as high as 5,000 meters. That's far above tree line. So hummingbirds are very unique as high elevation pollinators, certainly in the New World. And in comparison, the nectar feeding New World bats don't go nearly as high
right
in an elevation up a mountain, and they have not radiated extensively at high elevation. So hummingbirds are the champions of high elevation ecosystems in terms of pollination.
Let's talk about the nectar bats. How old a family is that?
Well, the family that they have evolved within, the phyllostomid family called American leaf-nosed bats, is around 36 million years old.
Okay.
The nectar feeders are advanced members of the family. The ancestral feeding habit in that particular family is insect eating, as is the case in almost all families of bats. But within 10 million years or so, the feeding habits of bats in that particular family just exploded into a variety of different unexpected unique kinds of feeding habits, including the vampire bats, blood feeders. And then there are carnivorous bats that really specialize on eating small vertebrates. And then you get the plant visitors, the nectar feeders and the fruit eaters. So that whole family, American leaf-nosed bats, has undergone a much more extensive dietary radiation than any other family of bats in the world, and probably, I've argued in another book, it's the family with the most diverse feeding habits of any mammal.
Now, no species of nectar-eating bat is exclusively nectar-feeding, right? They'll also take other things?
Yeah, there are, in the New World, real specialists with very long tongues, long snouts, and their diet is pretty much exclusively nectar and pollen. In the evolution of nectar-feeding bats in the New World, these bats have reduced size of their teeth, reduced number of teeth, which tells us that they've really given up insect feeding in favor of flower visiting and nectar and pollen feeding.
Now, one of the interesting things is, do they have hummingbirds versus the nectar-eating bats? Do they have differences in flower preferences?
That's pretty much the case. Of course, hummingbirds are diurnal in activity.
Yeah.
And so they're visiting flowers that open during the day and often close at night, whereas, of course, the bats are nocturnal. And so they're visiting a different set of flowers, even within the same family as hummingbirds, because their flowers open at night and close to sunrise in many cases. So there is no overlap in the species of flowers that hummingbirds and bats visit. They can be visiting flowers in the same family, like in the bromeliad family, but the flowers in many characteristics of the bat pollinators are really very different from the flowers of the nectar of the hummingbird.
Now, did I read this correctly? The flowers that bats visit are really stinky?
Often is the case. In the New World, one of the predominant odors is a sulfur-based odor that's really pretty obnoxious.
So like rotten eggs?
Yeah.
Wow.
The cool thing is that within the same genus of flowers, the Old World bat-pollinated flowers don't have that rotten egg smell, whereas the New World bats do.
Huh.
And why this kind of difference has evolved in a closely related set of flowers, we don't really know.
Well,
do
bats have strong olfactory senses that hummingbirds don't have?
Absolutely. Yeah, both the Old World and the New World nectar bats, as well as their relatives, all have large olfactory bulbs in their brain, and so the sense of scent or odor is very important in their food finding and food choices. Hummingbirds don't smell very well. They can smell a little bit, but their predominant, sense in finding foods and so forth is vision.
Right.
Rather than scent. Whereas in the bats, both vision, scent, and in the case of New World bats, echolocation are
right.
Very important in finding their food.
So just to make it clear then, so these nectar-feeding bats in the New World are actually smelling the location of flowers?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I don't have a great sense of smell, but in the case of certain cactus species that I've visited, I can smell their flowers from some distance.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So are there some generalizations you can see about the difference of the flowers that the hummingbirds feed on and the bats?
Yeah. In general, the flowers that hummingbirds feed on are tubular in shape. They are often red-colored.
Right.
And they don't produce much of a scent, if they produce scent at all. Whereas the bat-pollinated flowers, they can sometimes be tubular, but they're much larger on average, and they produce nectar with a strong scent and, of course, the pollen. So the sensory worlds of hummingbirds and nectar bats are quite different.
You've been working on bats for so long. We are running out of time, but you visited bat caves. Are nectar-feeding bats roosting in large groups like other bats do?
In the case of lesser long-nosed bats, that's certainly true. One of their maternity roosts contains at least 100,000 individuals.
Wow, okay.
In northern Mexico. This is a seasonal thing. Most of the tropical lowland forest nectar-feeding bats roost in much smaller colonies.
Okay,
in caves, in hollow trees, and things like that.
Okay, Ted, we're going to have to stop because we're completely out of time. My guest tonight has been Theodore H. Fleming. He's a world authority on the biology of plant-visiting phyllostomid bats. He's conducted research in Panama, Costa Rica, Australia, Mexico, and Arizona. And we're talking about his book. It's got so much more information in it than we've talked about. Birds, Bats, and Blooms, the Coevolution of Vertebrate Pollinators and Their Plants. Ted, it's been a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure, too. Thank you so much, Mark, for inviting me. You are in a different part of the world than I am.
So
I have three species of hummingbirds in my yard on a regular basis.
Even now?
Recently, I have a nectar-feeding bat, the lesser long-nosed bat, visiting my hummingbird feeder. So I'm in heaven.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.